Well, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan, president of Prosperity Financial Group, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Meet the Expert. Today is very exciting. We're going to learn things that most of us simply don't understand, and that is the world of financial technology or fintech. And we're going to have a great speaker on, Jay Jacobs, MBA from Columbia, from GlobalX. That's a $27 billion firm specializing in ETFs that are theme-based or thematic, another buzzword, in different industries. And this one thematically is about financial technology. And we'll touch on Bitcoin and the other platforms and digital coinage that's out there. And we'll do that over the next 20 minutes. So, Jay, let me welcome you.
Thanks, Elliot. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. I'm going to turn the screens over to you, and then we're going to come back for a series of questions. And I hope everybody enjoys the presentation.
Perfect. Thanks, Elliot. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I want to contextualize fintech a little bit in our framework of how we think about investing. So as Elliot mentioned, fintech is a part of our thematic approach to the universe or to the investing universe. So what is thematic investing? Well, thematic investing is the process of identifying powerful macro level trends that are disrupting major parts of the global economy. And then it's understanding who are the companies or what are the companies that really stand to benefit from the materialization of those trends. So we look at all these different themes, dozens of themes that are happening around the world, whether it's the rise of robotics and artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, the rising Chinese consumer, the changing relationship with our environment, all of these different things we look into and try to understand, is this a powerful theme that is going to change the global economy? Fintech is one of those themes. So very broadly speaking, fintech is the combination, as you can tell in the word, it's the combination of financials and technology. And that's literally what's happening in this theme today. You're seeing that the advancements in technology, such as digitalization, moving things online, the collection of data, the application of artificial intelligence to that data, is now not just being applied within the technology world, like when you log into social media or log into a search engine, it's being applied to different sectors. You might see it in the healthcare space today. If you go into a hospital, they're collecting information about you and collecting data from your vitals and storing that in the cloud and analyzing that information. So it's happening in healthcare. It's happening in shopping. Instead of going to a brick and mortar store and just paying for cash, you might be finding yourself shopping online where that online platform is collecting tons of data about you, serving a technology product to you that is customized to your experiences and is paid for digitally online. But we're seeing that with financial services as well. The technology is now going full steam ahead into the financial services sector in the world of fintech. Fintech encompasses many different components to it. It's not any single technology or any single kind of sub-segment of the financial services industry. It can include payments. So you might be able to pay for something in a store with your phone or your watch using digital payments now because that's connected to your credit card. It could be insurance, you know, getting insurance through a digital provider instead of in person. It could be through deposits and lending using a digital first bank. It can be through investing, using new tools that make investing easier than ever before, being able to collect and analyze data in a way that previously would have been impossible 10 or 20 years ago. And of course, it does include cryptocurrencies as well in the blockchain, looking at entirely new regimes for what is money and how can we use money and change the way that it is controlled and distributed across the world. So broadly speaking, there's really kind of two camps within the fintech space. And I mentioned a lot of different industries. I guess there's plenty of different kind of sub-industries within fintech. But I think about them as being in two different camps. The first camp is technology that is enhancing existing businesses. Think of these fintech companies as partners to your existing financial services firms. Maybe they offer software that makes something a little easier for a bank. Maybe they offer risk and analytics so that when you're checking your account, you can see new statistics about the investments you're making. Maybe it's specialized data, so data that investors never had before, or that banks never had before that now they get access to. Or it's customized enterprise software solutions, something customers are never going to see, but that is happening on the back end at major financial institutions to make their processes work better than ever before. They can be reducing costs, they can be managing risks, they can be improving processes, but this is all specialized technology that's helping the existing financial services firms do their jobs better. On the other side of the equation is what we would consider disruptive businesses. They're not looking to help the existing financial services firms. They're looking to disrupt them and potentially disintermediate them in the future. If you think about peer-to-peer lending, this is a technology that means instead of a borrower going to a bank and asking for money and the bank raising money from investors or through deposits, a peer-to-peer lending company is directly connecting the people who have money with the people who want money, disintermediating the bank. So that's a disruptive technology. Or think about crowdfunding. Instead of using venture capital or private equity to fund new businesses, crowdfunding platforms let people sign online and directly give money to new startups with ideas to be able to fund their ideas earlier. Again, disintermediating a part of the financial services segment. So this is happening in many different aspects as well, whether it's really removing the middleman, expanding access, using digital technologies to reach people who previously were not able to use them before, or unbundling services. Instead of having a one-stop shop, using technology to just have a company focused on one very specific thing. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the digitalization of banks, because this is really one of the key trends that we're seeing in fintech today. If you think about kind of the old model of banks, maybe you remember going to a bank branch and dealing with a bank teller because you needed to get cash or you needed to make a deposit or ask for a loan or you name it. But it was all really, you know, based around going to that branch, getting physical paper sent to you in the mail all the time. Now, of course, we've seen that that's become an increasingly digital process, that actually travel to branches has been declining. The number of branches has been closing at a lot of major banks. And people are trying to do as much stuff online as possible. So why is that the case? Is it about the consumers? Is it about the banks themselves? It's actually a little bit of both. So one of the problems is if you have a bank branch and the bank branch has reams of paper on all of its customers, that data can't be shared very effectively. So if you wanted a loan or you wanted insurance, that might be two different departments at a bank, but it's not that easy for them to share all of that information. It's disaggregated data. That makes it very hard and inefficient for banks to cross-sell or to offer more services to their customers. But if you move to a digital bank and you have all of that data in one place on that customer, suddenly they get a full picture of one's financial situation. That can be used for a lot more, that can be used a lot more efficiently for customers than if it's in bank branches and it's all disparate in different reams of paper. Another issue with non-digitalized banks: loosely integrated software. They're using some old programs, some new programs. That, you know, a lot of banks have seen a lot of M&A activity or mergers over the last few years and suddenly have 10 different types of email accounts on their platforms. Again, another inefficiency with these non-digitalized banks. And then lastly, there could still be a lot of manual processes. People in the back office, settling trades, updating accounts, things that can easily be done by technology today. So banks have invested hundreds of billions of dollars into becoming digital-first banks, or at least digitally enabled banks. What does this mean for the customer? It means you can get your data anytime, anywhere, logging into a mobile app to check your bank account, check your investments, get referred to for a credit card, or you name it. All that can be done online in a digital-first bank. In addition, that's a personalized experience. So instead of just a poster outside the bank branch telling you what a bank is offering, they might tailor that experience online on your phone to you specifically, to different, you know, offers that you qualify for or bank products that you might be interested in. The data can be updated in real time because it's online as well. So all of these things make the experience richer and better for customers in the fintech space through a digitally enabled bank. And on the back end, as I mentioned, a lot of this stuff is happening behind the scenes as well to make banks more efficient, which ultimately should be a good thing for customers as those lower costs get passed through. So that can be using all that data for predictive analytics, basically just trying to understand what the customer might be doing through all that data. It can reduce some operational risks, make the bank more scalable, all these different things on the back end that make banks kind of more flexible and primed for the digital age. This might seem kind of obvious today too, given the state of technology and how advanced certain FANG stocks are, like Facebook, Apple, and Google. But in the banking world, which is maybe a couple, you know, a decade behind that, a lot of these applications of technology are truly revolutionary and changing the banking experience for customers. So a few interesting stats. There's some expected spending of almost $500 billion by banks by this year in IT spend. 70% of that's going to be spent on all of this hardware and software and IT services that's going to make banks digitally enabled. So this is a huge investment from these old financial services firms to become as technologically advanced as many of their peers in the information technology sector. Now, this is just one small part of fintech. This is just the banking world and taking banks and bringing them to the 21st century with digitalization. But there's many different aspects of fintech as well. And I think one of the most common, or at least maybe the most familiar to many of you, is going to be digital payments, or basically the ability to pay for things through digital transactions. Now, a lot of this is using existing infrastructure. If you have paid for something with your phone, it is probably linked to your credit card. So the difference is somewhat nominal. Instead of just swiping your credit card, you tap your phone and it charges your credit card through an NFC chip. Relatively small potatoes. But what we're seeing here is there's many, many different ways to pay for things digitally now. On the slide you see on the right-hand side, we list the number of ways to pay for a cup of coffee at Starbucks today. But you can see you can pay through gift cards, through their mobile app, through Chase Pay and Apple Pay and Google Pay, PayPal, Visa checkout, credit cards, cash, digital currency, tons of different ways to be able to pay for things. So what is the advantages of some of these ways to pay for things versus other? We'll go into some of those details as well. But the key is that digital payments is increasingly becoming an option for how people might want to pay for things going forward. So the first convenience related to digital payments, the first reason for digital payments is convenience. The idea that if you're going outside for a walk and you don't want to take your wallet with you, you can simply bring your cell phone and pay for things. That's a convenience factor. You're kind of lightening your pockets, centralizing everything on your phone. That's probably, frankly, one of the key motivations for many people adopting digital payments is simply that streamlining of what they carry with them every day. But the second aspect is security. Because there's more data collection around your purchases when it's a digital purchase, there's much more information that can be processed and analyzed. For example, if it's going through your phone, it might require that you scan your face with the phone as if you have an Apple, or might require a thumb scan for your phone before you pay for something. That's a lot. That's a layer of security that is much more advanced than just simply taking a credit card and swiping it. Because anyone, if they get your hand on your credit card, can probably fake a signature and get through to purchasing what they're looking to purchase. But if you have to use your phone to pay for something and scan your face, that is clearly another layer of security. But the third aspect is the data that's being collected. So if you're buying that cup of coffee at Starbucks, Starbucks is understanding a lot of information about you in that transaction. What kind of cup of coffee did you buy? What are your preferences? Do you like black coffee? Do you like it with milk? Do you like it with sugar? What time of day did you buy that cup of coffee? Was it in the morning or the afternoon? What branch was it at? Was it close to your home or was it further away? All of this information helps that merchant understand its customers better and can make targeted advertisements to that customer based off of that information. For example, if Starbucks starts to learn that every single day you go to a certain branch at 2 p.m. and order a cup of coffee, and it's 2:30 and you haven't bought your cup of coffee that day yet, they can send you a targeted notification to your phone, maybe with even a deal saying save 50 cents on the next cup of coffee if you come to our store in the next hour. That's the type of information they're collecting when you use digital payments that's collected to your profile on your phone. So that's obviously extremely valuable to the merchant. And that can be valuable to you too, if you want that type of targeted information being sent to you. Lastly, it's a discussion of costs as well. Digital payments reduces some of the physical needs of maybe sending you a credit card if you lose your credit card, or the cost of taking out cash from an ATM. Because it's digital and it doesn't really exist in the physical world, it makes transactions easier and faster than ever before. Now, the third segment that I want to talk about within fintech is its use in emerging markets. Emerging markets like China and India and Brazil have actually been adopting digital technologies in financial services, in some cases at a faster rate than we have in the United States. And it's for a pretty simple reason. In the US, we've formed very strong habits for certain ways of buying things. We are frankly addicted to our credit cards in the United States, and it's very hard to get people to give up their credit card for paying for something in a truly, totally digital fashion. However, if you go to emerging markets, they basically skipped from cash transactions to digital transactions in just the last few years without that step of credit cards in between. So when you look at a place like China, they're actually far ahead of the United States in the adoption of digital transactions. What you also see is that these countries tend to have less competition. There tends to be a couple companies that are really dominating the scene. In China, it's Alipay. Basically, Alipay is a universal form of paying for things to the point where if you go into a New York City taxi cab, they now accept Alipay for Chinese nationals that are in New York City to make sure that they're able to pay for things. But I touched on leapfrogging technology. That's the concept of skipping over credit cards. But also government support. And these emerging markets that formerly maybe were focused on mining commodities or low-cost exports, jobs in areas like digital technologies are really attractive and really great for growing wages and growing the overall quality of living in an emerging market. So the governments have been extremely supportive of digital transactions as a way of stimulating that service as part of their economy. So we're seeing very strong fintech adoption. About 46% of emerging markets have adopted fintech versus just about a third globally. We're seeing that as mobile phones become more prevalent in emerging markets as well, that they're seeing more adoption. That, as I mentioned, those digital payments in China are growing extremely fast these days and has far exceeded the United States in total amounts of digital payments. In a major market like India, they got rid of large banknotes. So effectively anything above their equivalent of a $20 bill has been taken out of circulation to avoid fraud. That's moved a lot of people into digital payments as well. And then lastly, digital remittances, using fintech to be able to move money across borders in more efficient ways so that people aren't paying exorbitant fees is another driver in emerging markets. So as I mentioned, there's many different aspects to fintech, and we've covered just a few of them today, whether it's looking at the digitalization of banks, whether it's looking at different ways to pay for things, or whether it's the inclusion of fintech in emerging markets. This is why we believe it's a very powerful theme going forward. Now, Elliot, that concludes the presentation, but I know we have some specific questions that I think you wanted to touch on crypto and blockchain. So I'm happy to tackle those questions as well.
That was a great presentation. So I've got a series of questions here. If that's okay, I won't take too long. This was pretty simple for financial technology. In reality, it's just the more modern version of credit cards, isn't it?
Digital payments, absolutely. I mean, frankly, in the United States, digital payments has largely gone through the credit card still. So if you're using Apple Pay, it's still linked to your credit card and that payment is going through a credit company. What we're seeing in the emerging markets, though, is they've skipped that. That basically it's almost more like a debit system where you load up your bank account with a certain amount of cash, and every time you pay for something with your Alipay instead of Apple Pay, it's debiting that money straight out of your bank account. So in the United States, the credit card companies are so powerful, they've still managed to kind of squeeze their way into digital payments. But that's actually not what's happening in kind of the more cutting edge aspects of digital payments overseas.
Okay. I'll tell you what is hard to understand, and that is the whole crypto Bitcoin phenomenon, where it's gone from 8,000 for a Bitcoin to 50,000, they're mined, but they don't really exist in coinage. But when you put them on TV, they got a big B on them, like that they look like a half a dollar. And it's very confusing for the average person. And you just showed at Starbucks now that I could buy coffee using Bitcoin. And even more confusing, because does it exist or doesn't it exist in a coin form? So for a moment, let's just talk for a split second about what Bitcoin is, how it works. And is this something I want to run towards or want to run away from?
Those are great questions and probably some of the most pressing questions in the fintech world today. So starting at a very high level, you almost have to ask a fundamental question of what is money and what is value? In our current monetary system, we are strong believers in the concept of fiat currency, that central banks or treasuries can issue this concept of a US dollar that we all ascribe a certain amount of value to, and use it as legal tender to buy and sell services. And this is, and you know, not just in the United States, of course, the US dollar is the most widely accepted currency in the world and is largely the basis for the global financial system. So why would anyone ever consider something other than the US dollar to transact in? Well, there's still some areas of the US dollar that I think a lot of people around the world believe could be improved upon. Why does a currency need to be controlled by a central bank or a treasury? Does it need to be controlled by a central bank or a treasury? Should a currency really be based off of something physical, like an actual dollar bill, or should it be existing in the digital world to be able to reduce the cost of transactions and to be able to, you know, not be as controlled by regulatory bodies? Should you be able to understand everywhere where that dollar went? If you have $20 in your pocket, who knows where that came from? Was it acquired through legal means or illicit means? So a lot of these crypto currencies, including Bitcoin, are really trying to remake the entire concept of what is currency and can you improve on the current kind of thought around fiat currency, the US dollar. So Bitcoin effectively is the leading cryptocurrency today. It is built on the blockchain, which is a technology that I'm sure many people are hearing more and more about. The blockchain is simply a ledger technology that tracks how everything has moved through the system over time. So if you buy one Bitcoin, that is recorded in the blockchain. That is stored in the ledger, and that ledger is accessible by basically anybody in the world that wants access to that ledger. And the history of everything that has happened with that one Bitcoin that you own today is stored in the ledger. That's important for a couple of reasons, because now you know where it came from, but you can also verify that that person actually owns that Bitcoin. Because it's stored in that ledger, because there's multiple copies of this ledger around the world, it's very hard to illegally obtain something if it's not stored in that ledger that is stored in so many different places around the world. So it provides a record, and it provides an immutable record that can't be edited or changed or forged. And that is a very interesting kind of progression from holding a $20 bill, which really holds no information associated with it once you acquire it.
Okay, but Jay, and consumer beware, you're going to have, if I'm the Bitcoin owner, there are millions of prying eyes that are going to know that. That means they can start doing, they're already doing, some type of profile of me, digitally or not. I mean, you know where I'm buying my coffee, you know when I'm leaving the house. But more importantly, you know when my house is empty, you know where my children live, you know where the names of my grandchildren, you know the names of my first cousins, you know if they're spending any money, you know what their coffee is. In a utopian world, that doesn't matter. But in a world that's real and dark sometimes, could we be just making our lives more miserable down the road?
Well, this is a data privacy question. I wouldn't limit this discussion to just the Bitcoin, because frankly, this is happening in digital payments no matter what you use to pay with. Like I mentioned, if you use your credit card on your phone at a Starbucks, they are getting a lot of information about that transaction based off of the fact that you have a Starbucks app and it's loaded with your credit card and they have your whole profile. You know, why does Starbucks ask for your name and age? It's not to give you a free coffee on your birthday. It's because they want to know more information about you. So when we're buying things with a connection to our profile in an app or in any sort of sense, if we're sharing things online, if we're on social media, if our search engine efforts are being tracked, a lot of companies are collecting a lot of information about ourselves and they're using it largely to sell us things. So I think there's a bigger question around data privacy that fintech is definitely in that world, but there's a lot of different other areas of the economy that I think this conversation is very relevant to.
Okay, and one last question. Thank you again, Jay. And that is about the sovereign currencies of particularly the euro and the dollar. So I'm sitting here and I'm wondering that why would I, as a U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of the Euro, allow digital currency to challenge my hard currency? And maybe it's not. Maybe I'm just naive on that, but I feel like they're challenging it. And can't the governments, those two entities, turn around and say, that's it, no more, no challenge to our currencies, that's it. There's no Bitcoin allowed to be used in the United States or in the Eurozone. Could they turn around and do that?
I think there's a real regulatory risk to cryptocurrencies. There's no question. I don't think the government has moved particularly fast in trying to understand cryptocurrencies to create new laws that would somehow regulate how they're used. That just simply hasn't happened yet. So there's been a long ramp up and a great amount of adoption of cryptocurrencies that has now occurred, which means any future law is going to affect a lot more people going forward. And you see some of the largest financial institutions in the world backing Bitcoin now. So if you believe that before Washington makes any major moves and new policy that they might consult with the private sector, there's some very major players in the space that are going to be adamantly defending cryptocurrencies before any major regulations pass. But I think you have a very valid point, which is this does pose a threat because it's an alternative to the current system of fiat currency. But this isn't the only time that's ever happened. You know, people transact in gold. People transact in collectibles. There's other ways that people create and store value that goes far beyond Bitcoin and the US dollar that has not been regulated very much, or it's been regulated, you know, very lightly. So I think what's going to be the challenge for regulators is how do you specifically regulate something like Bitcoin and not other ways of storing value beyond cryptocurrencies? And just one more thing to add, Elliot, I think cryptocurrencies in particular play a different role for different types of people, right? For your average person in the United States that wakes up in the morning and buys a cup of coffee, cryptocurrency might be interesting, something you want to learn about, maybe, you know, thinking about it as a part of a portfolio. But the existence of Bitcoin may or may not impact your life very much. But if you're in Zimbabwe or Venezuela, a place with hyperinflation and massive currency controls, and a lot of questions about the store value and the role that the central bank plays in that currency, then suddenly Bitcoin holds a lot more value to you. It's an actual currency you can transact in that is not going to be massively manipulated or difficult to use. So I think there's a little bit of a different perspective in the United States versus some of these emerging markets where Bitcoin is kind of taking that role of digital gold as a new form of transactions.
Well, this has been great. I've learned a lot. We've been speaking with Jay Jacobs. He's head of research and strategy at Global ETFs. That's exchange traded funds or electronically traded funds. We use them. They are strategic partners of ours. Financial technology is a growing market. So it's where we use that in our portfolios. And if you have questions, give us a call. Jay, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great day, everybody.